with the sudden urge to find out more about the only person he could think of who was more alone than him. A librarian had helped him search, and as he'd read the old newspaper article in the cool air conditioning surrounded by the discreet hum of company, he had felt more at peace than he had in a long time. "So what happened to the man?" Sophie said. "It was this bloke called William Carlyle, and he actually lived on this property with his wife and kids. Two boys, about 7 and 10, I think." "Did they live in this house?" Lowe said. "No, it wasn't built then. They were somewhere closer to where the grave is now. Anyway, they'd gone out riding together one day and had got off their horses to have lunch or whatever. And suddenly, they realised a dust storm was coming." "Oh no," Sophie said. "I really hate them."
"Me too," Nathan said.
The sight of the sky turning red as a towering wall of dust bore down. The storms engulfed everything in their path, sucking away the oxygen and filling the air with missiles. They sent the cattle stampeding and reduced visibility to nothing. "You know how fast they come in," he said. So the stockman put his wife and the littlest kid back on their horses and told them to ride home. But the older boy had gone exploring, over the crest or somewhere, out of sight anyway. The stockman went looking for him, yelling out, I guess, while the storm would have been coming closer. Nathan thought for a minute. He remembered himself driving in desperate circles as he searched for 8-year-old Xander, and the way his heart had pounded in his ears and the fear had run pure and cold. Please let him be okay. It would have been worse for the stockman, alone on horseback, on the brink of a natural nightmare. Did he find his little boy? Sophie asked. Yeah, he did eventually. Nathan hesitated. But the kid's horse had panicked and thrown him off. The kid was okay, but the horse was gone. So what did the man do? He must have decided one horse wouldn't be able to outrun the storm carrying both of them, because he gave his own horse to his little boy. Nathan imagined the man telling, ordering, his son to go on without him, promising him he would find the other horse and be right behind, saying it and knowing that wasn't true. Did the little boy get home safely? Sophie asked. He did. But not the stockman? No. He would have known he wouldn't. That's sad. Yeah, it is. Although, Nathan paused. I like to think that maybe he wasn't sad right at the end, knowing that at least his kids were safe. He'd done it to save his family, Sophie said. Exactly. Nathan turned to Lo. So I know it can be a bit creepy out there, but it doesn't have to be. You don't have to be scared of him. Lo thought it over. Finally, she leaned in. Nathan could feel her breath on his face and see the specks of paint on her skin. I wasn't scared of the stockman, she whispered. I was scared of Daddy. Oh. Nathan took her hand. He's not coming back, though, is he? No. He's not, Lo. He put his arms out and she hugged him. She was small and warm. It's going to be okay. You're safe here, and we all love you. He pointed at her artwork. And you know what else? I reckon you're a better painter than your dad. He got a small smile at that. No, she said with something that sounded suspiciously like false modesty. Daddy's painting won a prize. That doesn't mean anything. Yours are just as good. No, they're not. Stop being silly. It's true. He got up. Hang on. Nathan went inside, his vision poor as his eyes adjusted to the light. Lunch smelled great as he passed the kitchen. Through the hall window, he could see Bub and Harry out on the grass. Bub was bowling now, letting Harry have a go of his bat. The door to Ilse's office was ajar, and Nathan toyed briefly with the idea of going in to see her. Say hello. Say he'd missed her. He hesitated but kept moving. The girls were waiting.
In the living room, Nathan stood in front of Cameron's painting. He raised his hands, feeling the buzz of an outlaw as he lifted the frame from the wall. It was surprisingly light for something that seemed to take up so much space in the house. Nathan waited a moment, but nothing happened. Cameron's spirit did not, in fact, rise from its otherworldly slumber to warn against the perils of leaving fingerprints on the brushwork. Nathan grinned to himself as he carried the painting down the hall, looking at the colours of the land and the sky and the grave. He realised that what he had said to Lowe was absolutely true. There was nothing special about this painting. There was no life in it. It was the flat, uninspired work of a man who was too blind to see all the good things he had. He stepped out onto the porch, the screen door slamming behind him, and was greeted by a stunned silence. Lowe's mouth actually dropped open. No one said anything for a long moment, and Nathan was vaguely aware that even the sounds of cricket ball against bat had stopped.
"Oh my God," Sophie gasped. "What have you done?"
But beneath her horror, her eyes gleamed with delight at the sheer scandal of it.
"Yep," Nathan nodded. "I touched the painting." "You'll be in so much trouble," she breathed.
Lowe was giggling, her hands over her mouth.
"I won't, because it's just a painting, Soph.
That's all. And yeah, it's pretty good, I suppose, but my question right now is it better than Lowe's?"
Lowe was hopping from foot to foot, equal parts thrilled and horrified.
"Okay," Nathan said. "Lowe, you hold up your best picture. Let's compare." With a grin, she chose one. "Sophie, you be the judge. Which is better?"
Nathan flipped Cameron's painting over in his hands. He held it up in front of his face, the painted side facing away from him. And all at once, the world tilted. Sophie's laughter was muffled by the pounding in his ears.
"I judge that Lowe's is better," Sophie was saying. 10 out of 10.
Her voice seemed very far away, and when Lowe cheered, sounded like she was underwater. Nathan tried to nod, but his head felt heavy and unbalanced. He realized the girls were watching him.
"I agree," he said, his tongue thick in his mouth. He saw Lowe's smile, but only in his peripheral vision. His gaze was trained on the back of the painting, specifically on something taped there. Something worn and opaque with fine red dust in the plastic creases. Nathan felt the ground sway a little.
"It's hot out here, girls," he managed to say.
"Go inside and grab a drink of water."
"Okay."
He heard their footsteps and the door slam behind them. Nathan's hands were shaking as he laid the painting face down on the veranda. The plastic envelope was taped carefully in the center of the frame. He fumbled at it, not caring about any damage to the front of the picture, and wrenched it free. He stood up. Beneath the dust, he could see the coloured edges of banknotes, the etched lettering of a passport cover and several folded official-looking certificates. Nathan felt his heart skip, as though there was a sudden hollow in his chest. He had not actually expected to find it, he knew in that instant. Not really.
"Don't touch the painting."
Nathan shot a glance around the deserted yard. There were no sounds of cricket ball against bat anymore from the other side of the house. He couldn't hear Bub cheering now.
"Shit, no, you don't mess with Cam's masterpiece."
In the distance, Harry's cabin stood dark and secluded, its door firmly closed.
"Don't you bloody touch it. You've done enough damage."
Behind Nathan, the house loomed over him, as though holding its breath. He could not hear Liz or Ilsa moving around. The windows to the kitchen and office were still and blank. "It belongs on the wall." Somewhere behind him, Nathan felt, rather than heard, the creak and tread of footsteps on the hall floorboards. A moment later, the screen door gave its soft shriek. He didn't move. He couldn't bring himself to look around. Golden rule in this house. Who had warned him? "Don't touch the painting." Everyone. Everyone had. The footsteps were close now.
I tried to tell you, a voice said. You never listen, Nathan.
He turned. Chapter 38.
I tried to tell you.
Nathan knew the voice as well as his own. He turned around. A few steps away, face partly shrouded by the shade of the veranda, stood his mother. Liz's eyes darted from the painting on the ground to the plastic envelope in Nathan's hands. She looked up at him. Her gaze was steadier than he had seen it in days.
That was nice.
Her voice was low. What you told the girls about the stockman, I could hear from the kitchen. Nathan's hands felt numb, like the envelope could slip through his fingers.
True story.
His voice broke a little on the words. Liz met her son's eye. Can I tell you another one? The rattle of a girl's footsteps rang out from the hall, and immediately Liz took a quick step forward and plucked the plastic envelope from his hands.
Not here. Walk with me, Nathan.
She took his arm, her grip firm, as she propped the painting against the house and slipped the envelope into her apron pocket. In the midday light, Liz's shadow had shrunk to a tight, dark spot beneath her feet as they crossed the yard. They walked towards the gum tree and stood under the gentle sway of its branches. At their feet, the graves lay side by side. Nathan could hear the blood rushing in his ears as he looked at the ground. Old dirt next to freshly turned earth. He had so many questions, he couldn't find just one to ask.
I'd gone out riding, Liz said finally. After Sophie hurt her arm and told us all that her horse threw her. We couldn't have that happening, not with her wanting to do Gymkhana. So I wanted to take her horse out myself.
Nathan suddenly didn't want to hear. But he closed his eyes and made himself listen as she spoke. On the day Cameron would fail to come home, Liz told him, she had done what she did every day. She saddled up. It was a habit she'd formed during a marriage. On a horse, she was taller and faster, and for a few hours at least, no one could touch her. That day, she was on Sophie's horse. It needed the exercise while Sophie's arm healed. Liz had ridden for longer than usual, feeling for any problems with the animal. The riding seemed fine, and the horse was responding well. Liz thought about Sophie's arm and rode on, trying harder now to sense the faults. She'd already gone further than she meant to when the thought first crept in, slick and dark.
There was nothing wrong with that horse, Liz said,
the shadows of the eucalyptus leaves playing across her features. I couldn't work it out. It didn't make any sense. Nathan thought of Ilse's car sitting neglected in the garage. That hadn't made any sense either, until it had. So I just kept riding. Liz went on. She had pushed ahead, growing more uneasy with every step. Sophie had been pale and shaking as she had clutched her injured arm, Liz remembered. She had cried and said she was scared, but she'd wanted to jump back on her horse the minute she was allowed. They'd all praised her for being so brave. Sophie had barely responded to that. The feeling in the pit of Liz's stomach had already started to take on a familiar shape when she saw the man standing by the stockman's grave. She slowed the horse. Her eyesight wasn't as good these days, and for a long minute, under the blinding sun, the man looked very much like someone else. Liz had stopped to watch, then walked the horse closer. She recognised the four-wheel drive nearby and breathed out. Of course it wasn't the man she'd first thought. There was no possible way it could have been. It was her son, Cameron. What was he doing? Nathan asked. He'd opened his eyes and was staring at the ground. He was digging. Cameron had had a shovel in his hand and was slicing it into the soft soil. Liz rode up, taking her time. Cameron had not been right lately, and even now he dug with a restless energy that set her teeth on edge. Liz dismounted and hooked the reins around the wing mirror of his car. Cameron had straightened then, wielding the spade in both hands. The metal glinted in the sun and she was reminded once again of a different man. Something about the look in his eyes. He wasn't pleased to see her. "Can I get some water for the horse?" She walked to the rear of his vehicle, where he kept his supplies. Cameron had waved a hand, his attention already back to the soft ground at his feet, as Liz found a bucket and filled it with water. She looked over as the horse drank. "What are you doing?" He bent down. "Checking something." "Checking what?" "Why my bloody wife's been dragging my kids out here." Liz hesitated. "I thought you were going to the repeater tower." "I am. Bub will be waiting. I'm doing this first." Cameron ploughed the spade into the sand once more, then stopped. He made a noise in the back of his throat. He'd found something. Liz's voice was hard to hear. The noise Cameron made was not quite one of triumph. The undertone was too hollow for that. Liz suddenly wished she had ridden in the other direction that morning. The horse had finished drinking, she saw with relief. She put the empty bucket back in the rear and turned in time to see Cameron stoop and dig his hands through the sand. When he stood up, he was holding a plastic envelope, opaque with red dust. "What's that?" Cameron smiled in a way that made Liz's stomach clench. "Buried treasure." I knew what it was. Liz rubbed a hand over her arm and Nathan could see both the recent skin cancer wound and the other, older scar that they never talked about. One of many. They all had those kinds of marks. Liz, Nathan, Bub, Cameron as well. Marks they kept hidden and never acknowledged. "I knew straight away what Cameron had found," Liz said. "I used to have something just like that myself." Liz's version had been an old biscuit tin, and she'd hidden it in the middle of a bucket of horse feed, or at least she had, until Carl had found it. The blow had burst her left eardrum, and her hearing had never recovered. But she'd learned a lesson, and she'd never tried that again. The boys had still been small, and she'd been too scared of the consequences. But as Liz had stood by the stockman's grave watching her middle son, she wondered how much worse the consequences were for her not having tried. "You should leave that alone." She had surprised herself by speaking. Cameron was surprised too and his eyes hardened. "You don't even know what this is." "I do, Cameron. I know." "Then you'll know it has nothing to do with you." He straightened then, up to his full height. The shovel was hanging by his side and his hands were gently gripping the handle. It hung loose. He hadn't lifted it, not even a little. He wasn't threatening her, he wasn't. But as Cameron stood there, with the metal blade catching the light as it swayed gently, Liz knew exactly who he reminded her of. He wasn't her little boy anymore. Or at least, he wasn't just her boy. He was his father's son as well. And she knew, as she had always known in some part of her, what Ilse had tried to tell her. And what Harry had been so worried about, and why Lowe's pictures were so sad, and why Sophie's arm was in a sling, and why it would be again, or worse. Liz flinched involuntarily as Cameron stepped past her towards his car. He tossed the shovel into the rear and slammed the door before dropping the envelope through the passenger side window and onto the car seat. Liz's horse bristled, tugging at the reins hooked over the mirror, and she whispered something to calm it.
I've got to get going.
Cameron didn't look at her. Things to do. Are you driving to the repeater tower?
Liz's voice sounded odd to her own ears.
Cameron walked back to the grave and started kicking dirt back into the hole.
I was going to, but...
His anger shimmered like the heat.
I might go home first. Have a word with Ilsa.
Cameron, please. The trickle of fear was now a fast-running flood. The girls are at home.
He said nothing. Then at last he looked up.
So? Maybe they need to hear this too.
And with the tone of his voice and the sun in her eyes, it was suddenly 30 years ago, and Liz knew, without a shadow of a doubt, what happened when men like that came home. She felt her hand reach out before she was quite aware what she was reaching for. She had done the calculation in her mind without realizing it. Calculations that had become an ingrained instinct years ago. Fight or flight. He was 5 meters away, 6 maybe, and he was looking down, distracted, kicking the sand to paper over the damage he had done. Liz was behind the driver's seat in the time it took her to draw her first breath, and she had turned the key by the time she drew the second. Cameron had looked up, but by then, her foot was already on the accelerator. She wound down the window and unhooked the reins from the wing mirror. The horse followed obediently as she pulled away. Not too fast. There was no need. A cantering horse can outrun a man.
Cameron tried, though. Liz's voice was hollow with horror. He really tried.
And he had, screaming as he chased her. He had known what was happening and he knew what it meant. It had taken every shred of self-control for Liz not to put her foot down and tear away from that terrible sound. But she kept a steady pace, with her ears shut tight and her eyes straight ahead. And eventually, much later, when at last she slowed and looked in the mirror, there was no one else around. She was all alone.
Chapter 39. Nathan stared down at the graves for a long time before he finally spoke. Cameron's car wasn't at the rocks on Thursday morning. Liz looked surprised.
You knew that?
I thought someone had moved it or that I was going crazy. I wasn't sure which.
I made a mistake, Liz said. I'd hidden it off the track near home, but I realised that night that it was too far away. He couldn't have walked that distance. When they found the car, they'd know someone else had been there.
So you moved it?
She nodded. Next day. I rode out early, led the horse on the reins again and drove to the rocks. I thought that was possible for someone like Cameron. About 10 kilometres.
It's 9, actually.
Liz didn't argue.
I just didn't want it to be seen too quickly.
Nathan said nothing for a while. He didn't want to think about it.
I didn't know what to do with Ilsa's documents, Liz said. I wanted to give them back to her, but I couldn't think how. The girls are always in and out of everywhere, my bedroom, the stables. Then Xander started pulling things apart in the sheds as well.
She shook her head. But everyone knows not to touch that bloody painting.
Nathan stared out across the property. At Cameron's car parked on the driveway and at the house where they'd grown up.
The way Cam died never felt right, he said. I really thought for a while that Jenna Moore had something to do with it.
He was quiet. The sun was approaching its peak in the sky. The horizon was a flat line in the distance. I wonder what she wanted with him. When Liz didn't respond, he looked over. What? Liz hesitated, then reached into her pocket. Caroline from the post office brought our mail with her yesterday. She thought we might not get into town to collect it for a while. She handed something to Nathan, and he turned the slightly rumpled letter over in his fingers. Cameron Bright's name had been written on the front of the envelope. There was no return address, but in the top right-hand corner was a stamp from the UK. It had already been torn open and Nathan pulled out the contents. The letter was folded into thirds and felt slightly worn at the creases, like it had been opened and read several times. He took a breath and looked at the words. Cameron, it started. Nathan did not recognize the handwriting, but it was neat and firm. Please read this letter to the end. I am aware that you may not even remember me, Cameron, but I need to tell you one thing. I forgive you. You may not want my forgiveness or feel like you have done anything that needs to be forgiven. I truly hope, however, that is not the case. Regardless of what you might tell yourself or what threats your father made on your behalf when he had me cornered and alone, you and I know what happened the night we met. You know what you did, and I do too. I used to hope that you would be living your life with the same sense of regret and shame that I have for years. That is no longer important to me. I have wasted years feeling guilty about something that wasn't my fault, and I have given you a power over me that you do not deserve. With the support of my therapist and the love of my beautiful family, I am proud to say that this is no longer the case. In so many ways, I have built a happy life. I wish the same for you, Cameron. Those in great pain cause others great pain, and I hope, for your sake and for those around you, that you have found some peace. Jenna Moore. Nathan read the letter 3 times. Then refolded it. He handed it back to Liz. What are you going to do with it? He said. I'll show it to Glenn, I suppose. It doesn't excuse you, you know. Nathan's voice was harsh, even to his own ears. It doesn't make what you did any better. I know. I saw what Cameron looked like at the end. And Steve took him away in the ambulance. All the damage. Nathan saw Liz flinch at that, but he went on. She needed to hear it. He didn't go easily. You should know that. He suffered a lot. She didn't answer and he realized she was crying. He didn't move. Finally, she took a breath. I'm not asking you to forgive me. Good. Liz was still for a long time. Nathan, I was 18 when I left home, she said at last. And when I did that, I promised myself things would be different. She had travelled north, she explained, and then west, going wherever she wanted and feeling free for the first time in her life. She had stopped in Ballamara only when it became apparent she was running out of road before the desert. Within a couple of days, she'd found herself a job in the post office and was earning her own money for once. Work was enjoyable and the locals were friendly. They always had time for a smile and a chat, and when Carl Bright had grinned at her over his mail and insisted on buying her a drink, she'd said yes. And for a while it was great. He was a lot of fun, believe it or not, and I thought he was so good looking. And he was nice to me. And for a while, my life really was different. Liz's face darkened. Then we got married and things started to change. And suddenly one day I realized my life wasn't so different anymore. Your dad had told me he'd had a bad time himself when he was young and we both wanted something better. but it wasn't better. It was the same as what I'd left behind. And I was so disappointed, Nathan. And I was just so tired. I'd come all this way only to end up in exactly the same place. I didn't have the energy to fight it. What was the point? She shook her head. But then I was pregnant. And I told myself that whatever went on between me and him, I wasn't going to stand for it with you kids. Liz wiped her eyes. She couldn't look at her son. And I tried my best, Nathan, please believe me. I made plans, I thought about it every day. But I was scared, and I felt so alone and trapped. I'm so sorry. It wasn't good enough, I know, not at all, but it was the best I could do. Liz was quiet for a long moment. And then your dad had that accident. And I believe that saved my life. Bub's too, possibly. Suddenly Nathan was back, years ago, on that hot, dark night, looking through torn metal at the sight of Carl Bright pinned between the roof and the steering wheel. The nurse's comment. It hadn't been quick. Liz's face had been frozen as she'd sat in the back of the ambulance with the blood congealing around her wound. It was the shock, Nathan had thought at the time. Maybe, though, a dark thought unfurled now. Maybe it was something else. He looked at the two graves at his feet for a long time. Old earth and new earth. Maybe, he thought, some lines were easier to cross the second time. How long? He started, then stopped. How long were you unconscious after the accident? How long did you leave it before you called for help? He wanted to ask, but he didn't, because he could tell from his mother's face that she would tell him the truth. Liz was watching him closely. I'm sorry for a lot of things, she said at last, but I'm not sorry he's gone. Nathan didn't ask who she meant. The gum tree rustled and Nathan felt the sand in the air and the grit on his skin. The screen door slammed in the distance and they both turned towards the house. Ilse was walking over, shielding her eyes.
Phone for you, Nathan,
she called.
For me?
His voice sounded strange. He cleared his throat.
It's Glenn. He says you left a message with the police switchboard.
Oh, yeah. He still didn't move. Then suddenly Liz reached up and pulled him to her. He could feel her hands, gentle on his back as she held him close, and smell the familiar scent of her hair. She had tears in her eyes.
I never meant for you to have to deal with this,
she said quietly.
I did what I felt was right in my heart. But you're a good man, Nathan, and you have to do what you think is right.
She drew back and looked up at him.
Either way, you should come home.
Liz held him a moment longer, then let him go and turned towards the house. Bub's got everyone playing cricket around the front if you want to join them, Ilse said, and Liz gave her a sad smile as she passed.
Thanks. I think I will. Lunch will be ready soon.
Ilse watched her walk away, then turned back to Nathan. She saw his face and frowned.
Is everything all right?
Glenn's waiting.
Yeah.
Are you sure? He turned his back on both graves and immediately felt a bit better.
Yeah. Come on then.
Ilse waited until Liz had disappeared into the house, then slid her hand into his. Her palm was warm and dry as they walked.
Listen, she said. Harry was talking about driving over and helping you with your flood prep, but
Her words came out in a rush. I was thinking he should stay and make sure everything's ready here, and I could drive over and help you for a couple of days. If you want. Nathan stopped walking and looked at her. I would absolutely love that. Are you sure? Because if you actually need Harry's help or Bub's, no, God, no. Is there much to do? No. But I should still come? Definitely. Okay. She smiled. Good. So maybe Thursday and Friday next week? New Year. Yes. She smiled. I suppose it is. They reached the veranda. Lowe's pictures were still pinned by rocks, the edges flapping in the breeze. Cameron's painting was propped up against the railings where Liz had left it. Oh, God, what is this doing out here? Ilse said as she climbed the steps. I brought it out. Oh. Ilse picked up the painting and held it out. The colours were already dulled by a light coating of dust. Ilse frowned for a minute, then without warning licked her thumb and wiped a long smudge from the top corner. It removed the mark, but left a smeared, wet thumbprint. The edge of her mouth turned up a little. Better. She put the painting back down with a clatter of wood against the floorboards. Anyway, I'll see you outside after you call. Ilse? Yes? Just... Nathan took her hand, her fingertips light against his. Are you happy? Now, I mean. Ilse's face clouded as she considered. I don't know, she said finally. It's been a bad week, bad year, really. But if you're asking me if I feel better than I did last week or last year, then the answer is yes. They looked at each other and slowly she took a step forward, leaned in, and kissed him. Nathan closed his eyes, and warmth that had nothing to do with the sun spread through his body, and he felt himself smile. I suppose when I think about the future now, she said as they broke apart, I can imagine being happy again, and I haven't felt that way in a long time. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, he said. I do. She opened the screen door and pointed at the phone off its cradle. I'll see you afterwards. Nathan watched her disappear around the side of the house, then let the door slam behind him. He walked down the darkened hall and picked up the phone. Hello, he said. Through the window, the cricket game was in full swing. The girls were taking turns bowling while Bub called out instructions. Nathan, Glenn's voice came down the line. Sorry, mate, I only got back late yesterday and got your messages. So we've looked into it, and this Jenna woman has been in Bali for nearly 3 weeks. Flights and passport movement all add up, and I called the retreat she's staying at and had a brief word with her. She said she was sorry to hear about Cameron, mate. Apparently she just wanted to send him some letter. Xander spotted Nathan through the window and waved as Lowe somehow managed to bowl Bub out. Bub fell to his knees in mock humiliation as the girls celebrated to a loud chorus of laughter. Bub pointed at Nathan through the glass and gestured. Come and help me. Nathan, mate, you still there? Glenn's voice sounded far away. Yeah. Was there something else you wanted to talk about? Sorry, Nathan said. It was... Ilse was laughing as the girls ran victory laps. Nathan took a breath. You know what, mate? It was nothing. Sure, message made it sound urgent. Lowe was at the wicket now, struggling with a bat that was almost as big as her. Harry bowled underarm, and she made contact and everyone cheered. No. I wanted to say... Nathan stopped. I wanted to tell you that I'm going to be coming into town more often from now on. I'm not looking to make any trouble, but I'm going to show my face when I want to. So tell whoever you need to tell, but That's what's going to be happening. Righto, Glenn said. I wouldn't say that was particularly urgent myself, but it doesn't sound like a bad idea at all to me. Thanks, Glenn. No worries. The cop gave a polite cough. If that's all... Through the window, Nathan could see Liz standing to one side, a little in the shade, a little unnoticeable, watching over her family. She looked at peace. Harry was giving the girls batting tips, while Bub said something to Xander that made him laugh. Ilsa was smiling, her hair shining in the sunlight. That's all, Nathan said. Merry Christmas, then. And you. He hung up. Outside, the light was dazzling as he opened the door and went to join his family.
We hope you've enjoyed The Lost Man, a Macmillan audio production from Flatiron Books. Production supervised by Catherine Carroll. Text copyright 2018 by Jane Harper. Production copyright 2018 by WF Howes Limited. All rights reserved.
My name's Ailsa Piper, and I'm here today, and I'm delighted to be here today, in a recording studio with Jane Harper, the author of three magnificent psychological thrillers, and Steve Shanahan, who's sort of her voice. And when you hear the two of them, you may be surprised at how unalike they are. Jane, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
And Steve, welcome.
Hello.
Yeah, you sound exactly like each other.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm Steve, by the way.
First of all, Jane, thank you for your three wonderful books. This is actually going to be placed, well, at the end, hopefully. And I should say, don't listen to this recording before listening to The Lost Man. Listen to it afterwards, just in case we hint at anything that's a spoiler. But, of course, also we'll talk today about The Dry and Force of Nature. So congratulations. They're three remarkable books.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm really delighted with the way that, you know, your readers and listeners and have responded to them. I've really enjoyed writing them, so I'm glad that people enjoy them.
The characters in The Lost Man, there's a lot of outsiders there, as well as the people who live in this kind of, you know, to me, very familiar place. I grew up actually on a sheep station, so it was very familiar.
Wow.
But, you know, you deal with the outsider, and I'm curious, do you feel like an insider now in Australia?
I think I do. I mean, I do. I love living here, and I've always sort of, felt very at home here, and like a maritime Australian, my child was born here, and I think, I absolutely feel much more at home, you know, here now than, actually when I go back to the UK even for visits. And I think part of that is just that there's so much to offer in Australia. I mean, I think as a writer particularly, you know, the landscape is such a gift. The people are such a gift. The kind of the situations that you can write about, you know, you really don't find... you know, anywhere else in the world. And I think this is such a fantastic opportunity.
So let's talk about landscape, because for a little English girl, you know, it's completely different what you've observed. I mean, what your daughter's observing to what you observed, it's entirely different. And the landscape is so central. It's a big character in all three of your books. Where do you look to for it? Were you always a sort of an outdoorsy girl?
Not so much. I mean, I like being outdoors as much as the next person, but I think, a lot of my, growing up, I spent a lot of time in, urban and suburban environments. But I think the feature of the three books, so in The Dry, it was this drought-stricken, country town, and Force of Nature is this sort of dense bushland, and then Lost Man, we've got this, sort of remote, outback, isolated landscape. And I think for all three of them, the settings have come very early for me. Really as part of the very initial idea for the plot, where could I sort of set this? And, I think they just really, it gives you, such a great kind of opportunity to set this scene for the reader and bring them somewhere that they maybe haven't experienced before. Also I think they lend themselves really well to kind of books with a bit of an element of mystery and suspense.
And when you're thinking about you know, the beginning of a book. Does the landscape come first? Because it does feel so integral. Does it come first or does the character come first?
Usually it comes really early. If it doesn't come first, it comes probably second. You know, just the initial idea for the book and where it will be set is it almost comes as one. So it's not a case that I have an idea for a plot and then I try and, you know, think of where I should put it. It's more, you know, I think about, you know, an incident has happened in an area and how could that possibly play out and what characters would be involved and what would their relationships be with each other. So, the setting is a really important part for it.
Mm. So there's an interesting interplay now that started to happen because this is the third book that you've read, two of which. So the first two books, of course, have Aaron at the centre of them, the character. And if you haven't heard those, you must hear them immediately, anybody listening to this. But The Lost Man that we're talking about here is a kind of a different standalone narrative, isn't it? You know, I mean, I was a bit, well, nervous about going to a book without him because he's such a charismatic character. Damage is really central to all the people, it seems to me, in your books. And I mean, you're studying psychology, Steve, at the moment, and the psychology of all these damaged men. I mean, you know, in all three books, the male characters carry damage. Was that something you're conscious of? And then for you, Steve, how do you sort of think about that? I mean, you know, I know you can't play damage, but there's got to be a vibration of that in the characterization.
Yeah, and there's different ways that people maybe not portray is the word I'm thinking of, portray damage, I was going to say, but people carry damage in different ways. Like some people successfully hide it. Other people don't even try to. And we all receive those different expressions of damage in different ways. Like, much as we like to help people, people that wear it on their sleeves too much can be a bit of a drag. So I find that's the interesting part in how to play it. And I always find that really clearly articulated by Jane. So tick. No, but I do. I find that that's really clear in the way you write.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that because I think, you know, with the books, you know, although they are mysteries, I think primarily they're character driven, and that's something that I think about, you know, closely before I start writing. And you obviously want the characters to be as authentic as possible, and I think part of that is thinking really closely about what issues will these people realistically be facing, and then when you've identified those issues, in what ways will they play out? Because as Steve says, people react in different ways, and people can have the same problem and respond completely differently. Mm. And I think you have to make that true to the character. So I spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, just, you know, behind the scenes, what's going on in the head, and how is that then impacting their actions?
And also the way that people around them are receiving them as well, but not everyone handles those people the same way, and there's people that Fork can be fragile around, but I think for the most part he's a pretty private character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was so good. I think having the opportunity to do, you know, to have some new characters in Lost Man. I mean, I really love writing about Fork, and I would absolutely, you know, hope to return to him in future books.
Oh, good. But,
yeah,
I'm curious about that too.
Can I read those?
Yes, don't shelve that voice just yet. You know, you'll need it again. But I think for this book, Lost Man in particular, it was set in, you know, such a different location out back Queensland, and I like to think about what characters will best tell that story, and in this case it wasn't Fork, it needed other people to really tell it, and I really enjoyed being able to, I guess, you know, bring in new characters and have a little think about, you know, exactly what their lives look like and what their relationships look like.
It's very pleasurable actually for me in this one that there isn't a sort of a detective, you know, going after clues, that actually it rises out of a family, because we all have those. We're not all, you know, I mean, there's great pleasure in finding a smart brain and following it, but there's for me, there was deep pleasure in this, in actually seeing how it came out of clashes between family members and old history.
Yeah.
You know. And the family dynamics as well, also, you know, a big factor, because, you know, someone coming from the outside, they maybe they have preconceptions, but they're not going to have the ties that people within a family have. So, I mean, at what point do you start, you know, pointing the finger at your own family members, or start trying to, you know, change this perception you've had for, you know, 30, 40 years about someone you've grown up with, and looking at them in different ways? I mean, it's a hard thing to do, you know, for everybody, I think.
Do you have brothers?
I do. I have one brother and I have one sister.
Right. Yeah. The brother relationship felt very, very keenly observed to me.
Okay. Yeah.
The father brothers.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think, again, it comes down to, you know, I think maybe less my own sort of personal experiences, and more trying to tap into those universal experiences. So, because I think that's one thing that, you know, I always try and do, because not everybody will relate to a family living on a cattle property in Queensland, but I think most people can relate to family dynamics and you know, and the sort of the way people are, you know, fill those family roles. And so I think it's more, I do try and, yeah, tap into this kind of universal experiences that hopefully wherever you live and whatever family you've grown up in, you can kind of recognise some things of yourself in that.
I'm very struck by the prologues of the three books. You know, the prologue for each book, you've employed a similar start, which is bang, you're here in the middle of this terrifying moment. Do you imagine that that's something that you will always want to do? It does feel, I mean, you can't say always, I know, but it does feel like a very particular sort of signature thing after three books, and they're so effective.
Yeah, I mean, I really, you know, I am sort of quite drawn to, I guess, that style now. I think with The Dry, you know, which is the first book I wrote, it just felt like a really natural opening. And then again with Force of Nature, I could just see the scene and it sort of set things up so well. And then so with The Lost Man, you know, that was something I was sort of quite conscious of, like, how would I open this? And it's interesting, with the other two books, straight away I actually knew, the scene, I could see it very clearly in my mind how it was going to open. And with The Lost Man, my initial thought actually started more where chapter one starts. So you see Nathan, the main character, driving towards this isolated grave, and his younger brother is waiting for him. And that was actually where I kind of started it. And I did consider, like, is that the point where I start the book, or do I, you know, do a prologue as I chose to do, which sort of set things up a bit more broadly? I think having the prologues, for me, it just helps set the scene very clearly in the reader or listener's mind, so that we're all there together, and we can all kind of move forward and you know, find out what's going on here, you know, as one, really.
Quite a lot of the you know, suspense writers I've spoken to will say that they don't know who did it when they start writing, and so you always have a plan.
Yeah, I do, absolutely, and I have heard very successful writers say that they just write it, and it gets to the end, it's a surprise to them who done it. Yeah. You know, I honestly do not know how they do that. I can't even begin to imagine how they come up with. I can't imagine their working process for that. For me, I always actually start at the end. What really happens, and then I think back to, like, what would be the perception, you know, taking into account, as we said, these people's experiences and their relationships, what would be the perception of what's happened, and how do you get from that perception to the reality, and what journey does that take?
There's a great tradition of people writing thrillers who've been journalists. I mean, in Australia I can think of at least three or four others. How much do you feel that background is still with you or fed you? I mean, obviously it gave you a practice, a writing practice, but
yeah, it really helped me so much. I mean, I think, you know, I still use those skills every day. So, I mean, I was a journalist for 13 years, and I was writing daily. I was producing, you know, your stories to order, to deadline, your certain lengths. You had to keep the audience in mind, and I mean, actually, you know, when we were talking about the prologue earlier, that's one of the things that, you know, I sort of learned from journalism, which was to, you know, get people in early, you know, really hook them, give them something they want to read on about. And and I think you never, in journalism as well, we're always told, you know, you can never assume people will read to the end of your story. You've got to keep on giving them, you know, interesting things they want to learn more and more and read on. And so that was something I was really conscious of when I'm writing the books, just trying to give people something that makes them want to turn the page.
Mm. It's a question for both of you, really. When you are working, you know, there's, I mean, you, Jane, seem incredibly reasonable, not remotely violent. You know, you seem like this lovely, warm, you know, adorable human being.
Don't be.
Who are you when you're writing these things? And for you, Steve, you know, do you take on stuff, anything as a performer? I mean, is there anything, any part of you that, I don't mean that you take on necessarily the characters of the role, but how do you change from work to daily life? What does it do to you?
I think for me, it again comes back to just trying to think about the characters themselves and what their, you know, what their experiences are, and how that will impact their behaviour. So,
but are you a rat bag when you're writing?
No, I actually try and replicate my journalist working life almost exactly when I write fiction. So I don't work from home. I go to like a little office and I sit there and I kind of have like working hours. And I just, you know, sit there and try and think what needs to be accomplished that day. And so I do feel a little bit, you know, a lot of it is not so much coming from me, but I do feel it, you know, it has to come from the characters. Like it's no point thinking how I would react in a situation because I haven't had their experiences and I'm not living this kind of lifestyle. So it's more how would I honestly think this person would respond. And that's what I guess I try and tap into.
Mm. Mm. So you sound like a really good writer to be around when you're working. What about you, Steve?
when I was recording Force of Nature, I was also studying a unit at university. I took a criminology elective called Serial Killers, Panic or Intrigue. And so I was kind of up to my neck in serial killers, panic and intrigue at the time. So if I was bringing my work home with me, there'd be trouble.
Jane would have the plot for a book.
Yes, correct. Yeah. So, I've learnt to just leave my work at work. But and I guess at the end of the day, I'm more or less acting when I'm doing this.
Yeah.
But it's I find it really fascinating the psyche of this, because it's a lot of the people I studied in units like that kind of start out, they're not really that different. And they start out and there's often a catalyst or, you know.
It's the old actors thing, isn't it? Given circumstances, anybody's capable of anything. And I mean, as a journalist, presumably that's something that you saw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I imagine.
I think so, and I think you know, as in newspapers as well, you see, you know, the sheer randomness of things sometimes. You know, people, can be living exactly very, very normal lives, and then something will happen to them, and they will react in a certain way that they never would have reacted had that thing not happened. Or and maybe if that those circumstances, someone else would have responded differently. But again, it all comes back to this kind of background and all of our, you know, our whole lives build up to, you know, maybe a moment when we react in a certain way. And I think that's something I always try and think about with the characters.
Mm.
Well, I think we've probably taken Steve away from his very important work for long enough, actually. So it's been a great pleasure to talk to you about the process. And is there anything that, you know, you've got the ears, just for a moment, Jane, of your listeners. Is there anything you want to just say on mic here?
I'd like to just really, really thank Steve for doing such a wonderful job. I honestly love the audiobooks. And, you know, I actually rarely go back and read the book in its print form, but I've listened to the audiobooks in their entirety, and it's honestly the closest I think I could come to experiencing the book, as a listener. It's almost like it's someone else's work when I listen to the way Steve has read it, and it really brings it to life for me. And I'm so delighted that he's done all three books. I think, with this book being a standalone, you know, I specifically asked if he could do it again, because I think he did such a great job with the Fork books, and I really, believe that he could, bring that talent to this book as well. So it was a real pleasure to get to hear him do a bit of it earlier, and I can't wait to hear the whole thing, the whole 9 hours or whatever it takes. So, yeah, thank you so much for bringing it to life so well.
Look, I love the books too, so, yeah, it's win-win.
Well, the nice thing is you don't know what's ahead of you, but that's I can right. tell you there's a cracking ending coming up that right. you will not see coming.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah. So listen, thank you both for taking the time. It's thank been you. A great pleasure to have a chat. You.
And now, a sample of Jane Harper's best-selling hit, The Dry.
Even those who didn't darken the door of the church from one Christmas to the next could tell there would be more mourners than seats. A bottleneck of black and grey was already forming at the entrance as Aaron Falk drove up, trailing a cloud of dust and cracked leaves. Neighbours, determined but trying not to appear so, jostled each other for the advantage as the scrum trickled through the doors. Across the road, the media circled. Falk parked his sedan next to a ute that had also seen better days and killed the engine. The air conditioner rattled into silence and the interior began to warm immediately. He allowed himself a moment to scan the crowd, although he didn't really have time. He dragged his heels the whole way from Melbourne, blowing out the 5-hour drive to more than 6. Satisfied no one looked familiar, he stepped out of the car. The late afternoon heat draped itself around him like a blanket. He snatched open the backseat door to get his jacket, searing his hand in the process. After the briefest hesitation, he grabbed his hat from the seat. Wide-brimmed in stiff brown canvas, it didn't go with his funeral suit. But with skin the blue hue of skimmed milk for half the year and a cancerous-looking cluster of freckles the rest, Falk was prepared to risk the fashion faux pas. Pale from birth, with close-cropped white blonde hair and invisible eyelashes, he'd often felt during his 36 years that the Australian sun was trying to tell him something. It was a message easier to ignore in the tall shadows of Melbourne than in Kiwara, where shade was a fleeting commodity. Falk glanced once at the road leading back out of town, then at his watch. The funeral, the wake, one night, and he was gone. 18 hours, he calculated, no more. Keeping that firmly in mind, he loped towards the crowd, one hand on his hat as a sudden hot gust sent hems flying. Inside, the church was even smaller than he'd remembered. Shoulder to shoulder with strangers, Falk allowed himself to be ferried deeper into the congregation. He noticed a free spot along the wall and darted in, carving out a space next to a farmer whose cotton shirt strained taut across his belly. The man gave him a nod and went back to staring straight ahead. Falk could see creases at his elbows where the shirt sleeves had until recently been rolled up. Falk removed his hat and discreetly fanned himself. He couldn't help glancing around. Faces that at first had seemed unfamiliar came more sharply into focus, and he felt an illogical rush of surprise at some of the crow's feet, silver-streaked hair and gained kilos sprinkled throughout the crowd. An older man 2 rows back caught Falk's eye with a nod, and they exchanged a sad smile of recognition. What was his name? Falk tried to remember. He couldn't focus. The man had been a teacher. Falk could just about picture him at the front of a classroom, gamely attempting to bring geography or woodwork or something else alive for bored teenagers, but the memory kept flitting away. The man nodded at the bench beside him, indicating he would make space, but Falk shook his head politely and turned back to the front. He avoided small talk at the best of times, and this, unquestionably, was a million horrific miles from the best of times. God, that middle coffin was small. Lying between the 2 full-size ones only made it look worse, if that were possible. Tiny kids with combed hair plastered to their skulls pointed it out. Dad, look, that box is in football colours. Those old enough to know what was inside stared in appalled silence, fidgeting in their school uniforms as they edged a little closer to their mothers. Above the 3 coffins, a family of 4 stared down from a blown-up photograph. Their static smiles were overlarge and pixelated. Falk recognised the picture from the news. It had been used a lot. Beneath, the names of the dead were spelled out in native flowers. Luke, Karen, Billy. Falk stared at Luke's picture. The thick black hair had the odd grey line now, but he still looked fitter than most men on the wrong side of 35. His face seemed older than Falk remembered, but then it had been nearly 5 years. The confident grin was unchanged, as was the slightly knowing look in his eyes. Still the same were the words that sprang to mind. Three coffins said differently. Bloody tragic. The farmer at Falk's side spoke out of nowhere. His arms were crossed, fist wedged tightly under his armpits. It is, Falk said. You knew him well? Not really. Only Luke, the... For a dizzy moment, Falk couldn't think of a word to describe the man in the largest coffin. He mentally grasped about, but could only find cliched tabloid descriptions. The father, he landed on finally. We were friends when we were younger. Yeah, I know who Luke Hadler is. I think everyone does now. Still live around this way, do you? The farmer shifted his large body slightly and fixed Falk properly in his gaze for the first time. No, not for a long time. Right. Feels like I've seen you, though. The farmer frowned, trying to place him. Now, you're not one of them bloody TV journos, are you? No, police, in Melbourne. That right? You lot should be investigating the bloody government for letting things get this bad. The man nodded to where Luke's body lay alongside those of his wife and six-year-old son. We're out here trying to feed this country. Worst weather in 100 years, and they're crapping on about scrapping the subsidies? In some ways, you can hardly blame the poor bastard. He stopped, looked around the church. It's an effing scandal, that's what it is. Falk said nothing as they both reflected on the incompetencies of Canberra. The potential sources of blame for the dead Hadler family had been thrashed out at length over newspaper pages. You looking into this, then? The man nodded his head towards the coffins. No, this here is a friend, Falk said. I'm not sure there's anything still to look into. He knew only what he'd heard on the news along with everyone else, but it was straightforward according to the commentary. The shotgun had belonged to Luke. It was the same one later found clamped into what had been left of his mouth. Nah, I suppose not, the farmer said. I just thought, with him being your friend and all. I'm not that kind of officer anyway. Federal. With the Financial Intelligence Unit.
Means nothing to me, mate.
Just means I chase the money. Anything ending with a few zeros, that's not where it should be. Laundered, embezzled, that sort of thing. The man said something in reply, but Falk didn't hear him. His gaze had shifted from the three coffins to the mourners in the front pew. The space reserved for family. So they could sit in front of all their friends and neighbours who could in turn stare at the backs of their heads and thank God it wasn't them. It had been 20 years, but Falk recognised Luke's father straight away. Jerry Hadler's face was grey. His eyes appeared sunken into his head. He was sitting dutifully in his spot in the front row, but his head was turned. He was ignoring his wife sobbing by his side and the three wooden boxes holding the remains of his son, daughter-in-law and grandson. Instead, he was staring directly at Falk. Somewhere up the back, a few notes of music piped out from speakers. The funeral was starting. Jerry inclined his head in a tiny nod, and Falk unconsciously put his hand in his pocket. He felt the letter that had landed on his desk 2 days ago, from Jerry Hadler. 8 words, written with a heavy hand. Luke lied. You lied. Be at the funeral. It was Falk who looked away first. It was hard to watch the photographs. They flashed up on a screen at the front of the church in a relentless montage. Luke celebrating as an under-10s footballer, a young Karen jumping a pony over a fence. There was something grotesque now about the frozen grins, and Falk saw he wasn't the only one averting his gaze. The photo changed again, and Falk was surprised to recognise himself. A fuzzy image of his 11-year-old face looked out at him. He and Luke were side by side, bare-chested and open-mouthed as they displayed a small fish on a line. They seemed happy. Falk tried to remember the picture being taken. He couldn't. The slideshow continued. Pictures of Luke, then Karen, each smiling like they'd never stop. And then there was Falk again. This time, he felt his lungs squeeze. From the low murmur that rippled through the crowd, he knew he wasn't the only one shaken by the image. A younger version of himself stood with Luke, now both long-limbed and freckled with acne, still smiling, but this time part of a foursome. Luke's arm was slung around the slim teenage waist of a girl with baby blonde hair. Fork's hand hovered more cautiously over the shoulder of a second girl with long black hair and darker eyes. Fork could not believe that photo was being shown. He shot a look at Jerry Hadler, who was staring straight ahead, his jaw set. Fork felt the farmer next to him shift his weight and move a calculated half-step away. The penny had dropped for him, Fork thought. He forced himself to look back at the image, at the foursome, at the girl by his side. He watched those eyes until they faded from the screen. Fork remembered that picture being taken. One afternoon near the end of a long summer. It had been a good day, and it had been one of the last photos of the four of them together. 2 months later, the dark-eyed girl was dead. Luke lied. You lied. Fork stared down at the floor for a full minute. When he looked back, time had moved on, and Luke and Karen were smiling with stiff formality on their wedding day. Fork had been invited. He tried to remember what excuse he'd offered for not attending. Work, almost certainly. The first pictures of Billy began to appear. Red-faced as a baby, then with a full head of hair as a toddler. Already looking a bit like his dad. Standing in shorts by a Christmas tree. The family dressed up as a trio of monsters, their face paint cracking around their smiles. Fast forward a few years, and an older Karen was cradling another newborn to her breast. Charlotte, the lucky one. No name spelled out in flowers for her. As if on cue, Charlotte, now 13 months old, began to wail from her front row spot on her grandmother's lap. Barb Hadler clutched the girl tighter to her chest with one arm, jiggling with a nervous rhythm. With her other hand, she pressed a tissue to her face. Fork, no expert on babies, wasn't sure if Charlotte recognised her mother on the screen. Or perhaps she was just pissed off at being included in the memorial when she was still very much alive. She'd get used to it, he realised. She didn't have much choice. Not many places to hide for a kid destined to grow up with the label Lone Survivor. The last strains of music faded away and the final photos flashed up to an awkward silence. There was a feeling of collective relief when someone turned on the lights. As an overweight chaplain struggled up the two steps to the lectern, Fork stared again at those dreadful coffins. He thought about the dark-eyed girl and a lie forged and agreed on 20 years ago as fear and teenage hormones pounded through his veins. Luke lied. You lied. How short was the road from that decision to this moment? The question ached like a bruise. As an older woman in the crowd turned her gaze away from the front, her eyes landed on Fork. He didn't know her, but she gave an automatic nod of polite recognition. Fork looked away. When he glanced back, she was still staring. Her eyebrows suddenly puckered into a frown and she turned to the elderly woman next to her. Fork didn't need to be able to lip-read to know what she whispered. The Fork boy's back. The second woman's eyes darted to his face, then immediately away. With a tiny nod, she confirmed her friend's suspicion. She leaned over and whispered something to the woman on her other side. An uneasy weight settled in Fork's chest. He checked his watch. 17 hours. Then he was gone. Again. Thank God.